This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Robin Hansen. He is an academic polymath with interest in physics, computer science, and economics. Robin, it's great talking to you.
Nice to meet you.
To start things off, can you give us a brief introduction about yourself?
Sure. Someone who just likes to follow interesting questions wherever they go, so I don't necessarily fit very well in particular categories, but I am an associate professor of economics. That's where I managed to find a home, and I can do a lot of things calling it economics. I have two books out in the last few years. The first one was called The Age of M, Work, Love, and Life, When Robots Rule the Earth. And the second one is The Elephant in the Brain, Hidden Motives in Everyday Life. I'm also known for work on prediction markets and many other odd topics.
So to start things off, with the coronavirus pandemic, you've written a number of essays and Twitter post about this. How effective do you think the lockdowns are as opposed to spreading out the pandemic over time? What increases the death rate?
Well, it probably is true that locking people down does spread out the pandemic over time, which probably does reduce the load on the medical system. I think people overestimate the value of medicine in general, and probably also in this case, but it's not to say there's zero value. And therefore, I worry that we are paying too much for too long a lockdown, or we will pay too much. We've hardly paid as much as we will. But I do see the basic value there if there's nothing else to do. I'm more eager to look for other things to do so we don't have to lock down for years and years.
Would you say that testing is more effective than lockdowns?
The usual traditional solution to pandemics is to aggressively test and trace right at the beginning. And it's clearly very effective then. The question is, once you've let it escape and you're no longer at the beginning, instead of having dozens of cases, you've got millions of cases. The question is, how much more effective can testing and tracing be at that point? So this one has escaped far more than any disease we've ever successfully contained before, but many people are hopeful that if we just ramp up and improve our testing technology and our tracing technology through apps on our phones, say, that maybe we will, you know, do something heroic that's never been done here and lock this thing down for the years it may take until a vaccine shows up.
You've posted about this concept of a controlled infection. I don't think any major public figure is openly talking about this, but how would it be safely managed? Have there been studies to show that it would reduce death rates? How much of a risk is it?
Okay, so we have to explain to our audience the key concept here. With many, probably most viruses, there's a dose effect. The bigger the dose you get initially, then the harder it is for your immune system to fight it, and so the more likely that you will suffer severe symptoms or death. There's also probably an effect by where in the body you get it, whether it comes through your eyes or through your throat or lungs or skin. There are a lot of apparently big effects with that vector for other viruses. And of course, there may vary in strains. There may be different strains of the virus. So the one default scenario is that over the next year or two, most people get infected in the world, and then they just get an average random infection that could be a bad infection in terms of where it comes in the body and the dose and things like that. So the idea is to, instead of accepting a random infection, to get a controlled infection where we choose the dose size and where in the body it comes in, etc. And data on other viruses suggest that could reduce the death rate among the infected by a factor of 3 to 30, which is enormous. Now, if we're going to somehow be able to not get most people infected, we're going to get a virus fast enough that they will just be cured without ever being infected, then it's well worth putting a lot of resources into trying to make that happen. But if we're in a situation where most people are going to get infected, then the choice really is between getting infected accidentally through the usual random route or getting a controlled infection, which again could be a factor of 3 to 30 lower death rate. So we don't know for sure, of course, whether this particular virus has a dose effect or an effect based on where it comes into the body. So we need, as soon as possible, a small trial, could just be 100 people, where we vary the dose and we vary the where it comes in the body, and we see how the symptom severity depends on those parameters. And so, you know, quite likely, I would put it, you know, 70-80% at least, we will see big dose effects and big effects on where in the body it comes in. And then, you know, we'll have something that we could use to infect people to get them immune. Now, of course, ideally what you'd want to do is deliberately infect the people who are likely not to get a very bad case anyway, the young and the healthy. And then as soon as they are infected and immune, which also seems quite likely for a substantial period, then those people could get an passport to go back out into the world and work and socialize, etc. And if enough people do that, then we have what's called herd immunity, and then the other people who are especially at risk may never need to get infected through any route. So that's the concept. Variolation is the name for using this sort of controlled low-dose infection for smallpox years ago. So I've been using the name variolation, just like our name vaccine now comes from the original cowpox that was used to deal with smallpox. And so we should just quickly do a small trial of variolation, and it would be a plan B. That is, plan A is somehow find a way to not get most people infected, but the experts say, you know, at least 18 months, maybe several years, maybe never, to get a vaccine for this. So it's spreading pretty fast, and there's quite a substantial risk that this will just infect most everybody in the world within a few months or a year, well before a vaccine shows up. And, you know, I think we just need a plan B to deal with that case.
So you're saying that it's inevitable, or based on your predictions, you predict that the majority will be infected at some point. I think with the Spanish flu, it was something like 1/3 of the world's population, and that was prior to airplane travel.
Yeah, so the percentage of the population that ends up typically being infected depends on how easily a disease spread. This is a relatively easy to spread disease, so that leads you to predict that a large fraction would end up being infected if you did nothing. And if we do a lot, that may just slow it down. So in some sense, the worst case may be that we trash our economies, you know, lock everything down for years, and still most everyone gets infected, and we have the worst of both worlds.
Do you have any thoughts on how different nations have handled the pandemic? Which ones have been the most successful? What cautions have they taken in particular?
Well, it's, you know, a standard observation that the Asian nations have at least initially been more successful, obviously because they had more aggressive policies. They had previous epidemics in the last 20 years that appeared there, and they experienced that more directly, and they were therefore more ready to have an aggressive response, and they have more strong central governments who are willing to do these things, and a more community-oriented population that's willing to accept that from their governments, all of which puts them together with, a strong government willing to take strong action, haven't had previous warnings recently, and so they took strong action. But even today, the West is not sure it's willing to do what the East did, and we're in a much worse situation because it spread much farther here.
What are your thoughts on any future plans to reopen the economy? Not necessarily like a hard quarantine, but a sort of soft quarantine until any type of vaccine is developed?
We're facing a very difficult problem, which is why I'm interested in pursuing this Plan B variolation. Without a vaccine and without radical new, you know, solutions, we're faced with a situation where we lock down and we manage to suppress it and even make it decline gradually. But as soon as we open up more, it reappears. And people have hopes that massive testing or massive tracing would be a solution here. It's never been done before at this sort of scale, at remotely this sort of scale. Maybe we'll have a heroic solution, but there are substantial obstacles to mass testing and mass tracing and mass, you know, authoritarian government controls of what people do. This is, we're just out of the usual territory of experience here. And I'm not that hopeful. I mean, this is the, these are the same governments that screwed up the initial letting it spread everywhere because they were kind of scared to do much. I mean, people initially, the experts initially said, you know, travel restrictions don't work and masks aren't important and things like that, which is what the Asian countries did. And now they're sort of reluctantly being dragged into considering more testing and more tracing. But, you know, even now we'd need hundreds of thousands of tracers out there, trained people to trace things. And, we aren't training those people right now. There's not masses of people being collected together and trained and set up to do that. People are trying to make more tests, but, it's not clear we can, like some people say, we should test everyone once a week. Well, you know, that's, pretty ambitious and hard to even believe in the United States. At the world level, it's even worse. So I'm actually thinking not just about the West and the rich countries, also about the rest of the world and how to keep them. I mean, mass testing and tracing in Nigeria and Indonesia and everywhere else in the world seems even more crazy to pull off in the next few months.
For some countries, a lot of the Asian countries, and I think Israel as well, they've tracked people who have been infected by their phone, and they've tested like where they've gone, who they've interacted with, and this definitely brings up a lot of civil liberties and privacy concerns. But under like a surveillance state, that someone could be like notified on their phone if they come in close contact with a person that's been infected, but then obviously that gets very Orwellian.
Well, even setting aside the Orwellian part, you know, there's what happens once a government gets in the habit of that, and what do you trust it to do in the future, and how well will it manage making a lot of difficult choices. But even ignoring all of that, it's just a matter of scale. Look, testing and tracing is the usual standard solution for pandemics, and it works on at the very beginning of a pandemic when there's only a few dozen people or most 1,000 people or so infected. We've got millions worldwide now, and the question is, can we scale up testing and tracing even with apps, even with new technology to that scale and make it last for years? Because basically, there's, you know, any place in the world that fails can then reinfect the rest of the world. I mean, there's this, you know, saying that doesn't make much sense to have a peeing section of a swimming pool. Why? Because the pee will spread to the rest of the pool. So if one place manages to lock down and having test and trace and manage to suppress it there, they have to keep their borders pretty tightly shut to prevent other places in the world that haven't managed to suppress it from infecting them back again. Even today, Singapore did a great job initially, but now they've got people coming back. China did a good job initially, at least after failing initially. But second, they did a good job, but now they've got more people coming back. As large fractions of the world get infected, it becomes much harder to prevent a few places, even just a few places that let it go wild from infecting the rest.
Yeah, that definitely will be an issue to see, like, if there's a political will for those kinds of travel bans and just the way the global economy functions. With the United States right now, the media is saying that it's peaking and starting to stabilize. But for the United States, do you think there's a good chance that that containment will fail and the numbers of infections and deaths could start to accelerate again, especially if there's a sort of loosening of the quarantine?
It's pretty certain that loosening of controls will risk growth again. I mean, look, we've been having a very rapid growth until recently, and now maybe it's declining. But even if it's declining at a slow rate, that doesn't, you know, it takes many months for that to get down to smaller levels. And You know, even then you've got lots and lots of infected folks. I mean, the key question is, how much can you suppress it for how long? Obviously, even if now we are in a slight suppression mode, that might mean it's, you know, falling by a factor of two every month. When you go from a million people, you know, how many months does it take falling by a factor of two every month? Well, that takes 2 years to fall by a factor of a million, right? So, you know, that's the key question is it's not enough that it might be peaking now and slowly declining because you're still having a strong lockdown. What happens when you try to let up and you're also trying to keep this thing? I mean, it's just, maybe we will have a heroic solution, but it doesn't look good, and we just need a plan B for if this doesn't work.
You were posting about this on Twitter, but what are the different, the risk score for different activities?
Yeah, so I did a sort of practical thing to let you and your household, you know, rate how risky you are. So, you know, as usual, probably we're all locking down and paying big costs, but a small fraction of us are probably the problem people who are allowing this thing to spread more than other people. And in fact, that's what I seem to see in my statistics. A small fraction of us are doing most of the exposure. So, and they may not even realize that they are the small fraction who are doing it more than others. So I set up a little, I took 19 activities that you might be doing that might risk exposure. And I asked 18 surveys where I asked people to rate how much of a risk that is relative to the first one. And then I used those responses to produce estimates of the relative risk of these activities and set up a little spreadsheet where you can calculate your risk by entering how often you do each one. And then I had a survey asking people what their score was, and that score is highly unequal. You know, again, a small fraction of the population is doing most of the risk. So, you know, it might be good if people knew what the risk was. So maybe the high-tail people are going, oh, I didn't realize that, and they could cut back. Or maybe we could even, you know, find some ways to score people and you know, encourage or, you know, regulate their exposure. But, you know, most people are honestly trying to limit it, and maybe they don't really know what are the more risky things they're doing. Like, how risky is it to take out the trash, to pick up the mail from the mailbox, and order a pizza, to, you know, et cetera, to take a bus ride?
As far as risks go, is the risk primarily being indoors, or if you're going out on a walk and you pass someone on a sidewalk and they cough, like how much of a risk is that?
Right, so that's the sort of thing you and I might not know. And a lot of people are making their choices based on pretty crude guesses of these things, and their guesses vary a lot. So I thought there would just be value in putting together some scores, and my scores were just based on people's perceptions, but at least, you know, the average perception is probably better informed than the random perception. And that's what I put together. Now, one person put a response on that blog post where he tried to do a calculation, and his calculation estimates were correlated, you know, 3/4, 75% with my survey estimates, which suggests the survey estimates aren't terrible.
Before we move on to a different topic, is there anything else you'd like to add about the pandemic?
I guess the surprising thing, or the sad thing, is just how the way we think about disease and pandemics is just sort of frozen in tradition. And, you know, times of crisis are times for flexibility and thinking more generally. You know, the more the world stays the same, the more people just get in habits of doing what seemed to work before, and the less general is their thinking. They don't think in general about how to solve general problems. They just keep doing what they've been doing. When you have a sudden change in the environment, like a war or pandemic, that's exactly the time when the best response is to start to be more general, to back off, and instead of just doing what you did before, think more fundamentally about how things work. And that's what we should be doing with this pandemic. The concept of variolation is just an obvious, well-known historical thing. And so I'm really still floored by me being one of the few people to talk about this concept as if it was just a forbidden topic. And so a lot of people in the medical world and the, you know, the epidemiology world have just frozen in with this idea, you should never give anybody any, you know, treatment that has any substantial risk, because that would just be terrible. That's immoral. Now, and that may make sense as a policy in ordinary times, but in a crisis unusual time, we need to go back to fundamentals and ask, sure, it has a substantial risk, but if that risk is much less than the risk you would get by getting this accidentally, and we don't have any other treatment coming, shouldn't we more flexibly reason about relative risk and do the thing that has the lower risk, even if the risk isn't zero? Anyway, that's my comment.
As far as, like, back to the controlled infection, how much of a taboo is it? I mean, there could be a medical ethics that it violates the Hippocratic Oath if there's a risk that someone could get sick, and possibly in some cases there could be deaths. But has there been any, like, mainstream medical officials or politicians who have proposed it?
I mean, I found, you know, half a dozen or so other people who have taken it seriously and written about it. And most of the people I know who are willing to consider it are people who are relatively polymaths, sort of generalist thinkers, rather than people really steeped in sort of the tradition of medical ethics, say, or you know, medical regulation.
So your book, The Age of M, it's a science fiction novel that deals with a future scenario where human minds would be implanted into machines?
So it's like science fiction, except there's no plot and there's no characters and it all makes sense. And that last part is all the work. I've been a science fiction fan all my life, but the more I learned in life, the less I enjoyed science fiction because the less of it made sense. The science fiction authors are trying to make a roaring, entertaining, engaging tale, and making it realistic is a burden on that task, and so they only make it as realistic as they think their typical reader would notice, and which isn't very realistic. Most people don't understand not only much technology, but much social science. I wanted to think about a future scenario where it made sense, where you know, you thought through the technology and the social dynamics, and you came up with a scenario that fit with our best understanding of those constraints. That's not done very often, and I really exactly wanted to show that it was possible. So The Age of M is my effort to take a very standard futurist science fictionist sort of assumption that brain emulations are possible and could be cheap and widespread, and actually carefully work out what would happen.
I know there's a whole transhumanist scene, but how much research has there been done into brain emulations, the concept of uploading brains onto AI?
So let's just tell people what brain emulation is. So it also goes by the name upload, for example, and many science fiction stories have included it as a basic element. There's a new one coming out May 1st, apparently, on Amazon called Upload.
Ghost in the Shell was the last big one.
Ghost in the Shell is a closely related concept. It kind of has them, although I think the TV show bit differed a bit from the novels in that way. But yes, so the key idea is that you take somebody's actual brain, which we know works and can be intelligent and is a physical device, and we scan that brain in fine spatial and chemical detail to see exactly which kinds of cells are where connected to what. And then we need computer models of how each kind of cell works in terms of taking inputs, changing internal state, and sending outputs. And if you have good enough models for all the kind of cells and you have a good enough scan of the entire brain, then you should be able to put together a computer model of the same brain, which has roughly the same input-output behavior. That means you could hook it up with artificial eyes and ears and hands and mouth, and then you could talk to it and it would talk back. You could ask it to do things and it might do them just like the original person would have done in the same situation. It's a work-alike for that original brain. That's the idea of an emulation. And yes, people have looked at that concept, but of course, we're a long way from being able to do it. The T technologies you need are three. One, you need lots of cheap, fast parallel computers. We, of course, have a whole industry working on that, and it's on the way, but it probably isn't there yet in terms of being cheap, fast enough. Second, you need to scan individual brains at fine spatial and chemical detail. Now, we actually are pretty close to being able to do that, except for the point of not knowing which chemicals we need to be scanning for. If we knew exactly which chemicals were sufficient to be scanning for, we could probably do this for a relatively modest cost. We have already done decent scans of, say, mice, which have only 1/1000th of the volume of the human brain. And the third technology we need is these models of cells. And we actually have a lot of decent models for a lot of kind of cells, but hey, we need them for all the cells in the brain. So we've had people look at, you know, modeling brain cells. We've had people working on scanning brains. We've even had people thinking about what it takes to put all these together and projecting timelines and when that might be possible. And quite plausibly, sometime within the next century, maybe even 30 or 40 years, but sometime in the next century looks like the most likely time this would become possible. Not in the next 10 or 20 years, but in the foreseeable future.
Do you address the issue of whether it's just data saved to the AI or whether the humans will remain an actual consciousness or a sentient state?
So you're referring to a dispute that people have about what it takes to produce consciousness. And in some sense, at the basic level of the dispute we have, we will never get any more data than we have now. And so we will never know more than we do now. So as you know, you feel conscious, and the people around you, you presume are conscious, but you don't know if they're conscious. And you don't know if you swapped the neutrons in their cell, in the atoms in their brain with a different kind of neutron, whether they'd be conscious. You don't know if you put more potassium in their brain or less, whether they'd be conscious. You just really don't know what consciousness depends on, because in fact, you've never had any other data on consciousness other than the fact that you feel conscious right now. You don't even know if you were conscious in the past or will be conscious in the future. And none of us have any data other than that one presumed data point, is that we feel conscious right now. And so, you know, you have to make some presumptions. I wanted to avoid that whole debate in my book, Age of M, so I just assumed that even if they weren't conscious, they would act the same. And so I could still describe the whole world even if they weren't conscious. I think they'd be conscious, but I have no way to prove or even empirically show that, because in some sense, none of us will ever have any data on this.
I think in that future scenario, it could very well be possible that even they wouldn't know whether the AI is conscious or just replicating the data that it scanned from the brains.
Well, like I say, under this concept that, I mean, some people say, you know, imagine the same exact physical universe, but things in that physical universe not being conscious, or some of them not being conscious. If they think that is a coherent scenario, then in some sense, no data about the physical universe we can see ever tells us anything about what's conscious. And in fact, you don't even know if you're conscious right now. I mean, you presume it, you believe it, but you don't actually have any data showing it.
Has there been a lot of scientific studies on that issue of consciousness?
Well, like I just said, you can't study it because there is no data. There can never be data. So people talk about it and argue about it, but that's all they can really do, is just talk about what seems plausible to them or reasonable. You know, so you might say, well, I'm conscious, surely other people must be, of course. But we'd say, well, what do you mean, surely? How do you know? And they just say, I just presume. If I'm conscious, other things must be, because I think other things made out of the same materials as me must, you know, have the same experiences as I do. And but of course, you might say, no, there's no, that's not logically required. And so, you know, if you think, if we replace the, you know, the nuclei, neutrons in your brain with ones with a different character, you would still be conscious, then, you know, you're making some presumptions about what it depends on. And so I'm, you know, obviously, by definition, in some sense, these emulations will claim to be conscious. They will have exactly the same brain processing that your brain does, that produces this calculation to say that it thinks it's conscious. So they would have the same degree of articulation. So they would passionately argue for being conscious, just like you might. And they would be very sure of it. And they would be, they're programmed, of course, to be very sure, just like you are. But if you reject that as data, what else you got? There's nothing to go with. So, you know, I really think this is a place people get stuck on. There's just no way to resolve it. Let's just get past. So my attitude in this book was, like, people get so stuck on this, they don't get past this and ask, what is this world like? And that's where I wanted to go. I wanted to say, assuming, you know, this world becomes possible, what does it look like?
In the Age of M, you do discuss how the world will change the economic, the class, and social structure.
I talk about as many things as I can. I try to do sort of a complete summary, high-level summary, of course, of all the different major areas of life and society. And for each one, I ask, what does our basic, simplest theories predict about how this world would be different? And, you know, I'll try to put together a scenario where these things are all consistent with each other.
So the economy would double every month, but wages would fall to a subsistence level.
Right. So today, we can make stuff in factories. And in fact, the value of stuff that a factory makes is about the same as the value of that factory in just a few months. So if we could make everything in factories, we could double the economy every few months. That's actually not crazy. That's actually what we see today. The problem is we have other things that are valuable, i.e. humans, who don't double every few months. So there's not that much point in making lots more machines if you don't have people to work with them, which is why the economy, instead of doubling every few months, doubles every 15 years now. But with M's, you can basically make a substitute for humans in factories. You can make everything about the economy, therefore, in factories, and therefore the economy can double every few months and even months and even faster.
And what would happen to all the humans? Would they become obsolete?
So it's similar to how in the past, when we transitioned from hunting and gathering to farming and from farming to industry, some people stuck with the old ways and they could continue in their old ways if they wanted, but they became marginalized. The hunter-gatherers, you know, were more and more up in the mountains or deep in the forests and didn't have the prime land. And then the industry took over and the people who are still doing subsistence farming out there, they're still on marginal lands and marginal places. They don't make much money. And they aren't the center of the world. So same way in the Age of M, moving from being a human to an M is an available option for all humans at this point in the scenario. And if you choose not to do that, you are choosing not to adopt the latest technology at a cost to yourself. That's possible, but you become marginal.
Would you consider becoming an M yourself if you granted the opportunity?
Absolutely. Now, as we've said, this is a competitive economy, and it's more competitive than our economy. And the M economy really only needs a few hundred kinds of workers. And so out of all the billions of humans who are available to make copies of, most M's end up being copies of the best few hundred humans. So I don't have any reason to believe that I'm going to be one of those best, but I could pay some of my resources to become an emulation, and then I could live a life of luxury as an emulation much more cheaply than I could as a human. So I could become an emulation and enjoy my life there and even be immortal, but I don't particularly expect to be one of the few hundred most competitive for whom the economy is eagerly seeking out and making billions of copies of.
You also wrote this post a while back about incels, and it's more of, I'd say, a thought experiment than rather an explicit political advocacy, but you just put out a thought experiment comparing it to class-based arguments about economic inequality.
Right, so I'm more of a theorist, more of a person who tries to understand the world, and I'm always struck by this apparently similar things that are treated differently, trying to understand why. And how people treat inequality is full of these sorts of puzzles of apparently similar things that people care differently about or treat differently. So in addition, we care about inequality within the family. We care about equalities between families within a nation. We care about inequality between nations. We care about inequality across different times. We care about different kinds of inequality. We care about prestige. We care about popularity. We care about accomplishment. And we care about sex. We care about having sex and having enjoyable sex with people we want to have sex with. And it's interesting that the way people talk about inequality doesn't treat these various kinds of inequality roughly equally. It's actually quite distinctive. So, for example, if we just talk about monetary inequality, we see that the most of the discussion about inequality is about inequality between the families of a nation. But in fact, the inequality within families and between nations and between times, each of those other three kinds of inequality is larger than the inequality between the families of a nation. Nevertheless, we focus almost entirely on that inequality between families of a nation when we talk about inequality and how we're mad about it and something needs to be done and society will crash if we don't do something. But we don't pay much of attention to those other three kinds of monetary inequality. And then if we go outside of money, we see very little interest or attention in inequality of popularity, inequality of lifespans even, inequality of happiness, and inequality of sex is a striking aspect. So there were, at the time I wrote the post, some people who called themselves incels and who said they were complaining about inequality of sex. And I said, yeah, that's kind of interesting that here are these people claiming about that. And that's similar to the way that people complain about monetary inequality. And I traced out some of those similarities. So first of all, they say it's unfair. Secondly, they say, there should be some redistribution, some way we change the distribution of how things go out so that they get more. And they threaten to do violence sometimes and even do violence, and other people are often supportive. So for monetary inequality, you may not know that in the 1970s, there were thousands of terrorist attacks where people blew up bombs and things, killing many people in the name of inequality, in the name of Marxist sort of advocacy for reducing, you know, financial inequality in society. And a lot of people supported those things and said, yay the bombers for calling attention to bad inequality in society. And then when you get these recent people complaining about inequality, and a few of them go out and hurt some people in the name of their complaint, a lot of people said, what terrible people for doing that. And no, we don't support them. And the same sort of people exactly who would be supporting of the Marxist complainers were exactly the people who were the most opposed and disliking and disapproving of the people complaining about sexual inequality.
Oh, so you're saying the people who are the most opposed to incels, are they the people discussing economic inequality and saying we need to redistribute wealth, or are they from people who would more likely to be defending a hyper-competitive economic system, or
no,
probably
so
a combination of both?
Yeah, the people who are most hostile to the sexual inequality complaint are the people who are usually the most sympathetic to the income inequality complaint.
There's actually a lot of debate about this, including a lot from incels themselves. Would you say that most of those people are people who are economically disadvantaged or not necessarily?
There is a weak correlation, but it's not huge. Yes, on average, people who are poorer are probably less sexually attractive. But, you know, today in a rich society, people who are sexually attractive, being rich isn't a very big part of it. In poorer societies, being rich is more of an attraction. But now we're rich and comfortable enough that people can have sex with the people they feel like having sex with, and they don't get pushed that much to be attracted to the rich.
And then there's also like what we consider privilege. So there's identity politics, so that there's like the concept of white privilege or gender-based privilege. And then from there you have economic-based privilege. And then there's also social status and popularity. And that gets more complex because you can be from a lower class and
sure.
have high social status within that class and vice versa.
So no doubt there are weak correlations between these things, between race and gender and class and ethnicity and other sorts of things. But again, some people who say are really concerned about, racial inequality, they might, if they believed that the less popular races also had less sexual attraction, then they would say, yes, and that's another reason why we need to deal with racism. No, we don't need to deal with sexual inequality in any other way than dealing with racism and classism and sexism and sexual preferenceism and all those other sorts of things. So they would be mildly sympathetic to sexual inequality as a reason or justification for dealing more directly with other kinds of inequality, but they're not very sympathetic to directly dealing with sexual inequality.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Robin Hansen, is there anything else you'd like to add about any of these topics? Or about any upcoming project you have?
I do have another book called The Elephant in the Brain, Hidden Motives in Everyday Life, co-authored with Kevin Simler. And it's about how we don't actually know why we do a lot of the things we do. We have beliefs about our motives that are quite wrong a lot in a lot of areas. And that's related to a lot of these things I'm interested in. A lot of puzzles in the world can be better explained by realizing that people are just doing things for different reasons than they say. And that's related to inequality. So I think the explanation for why we care much more about inequality between the families of a nation and even about financial inequality than other inequality is that behind the scenes, even in our subconscious, inequality talk is a lot about grabbing. We want to grab stuff from people. Grabbing money is easier than grabbing other things, and grabbing between the families of a nation is easier than grabbing in other way across other boundaries. And so we talk a lot about inequality and being concerned about it as a prelude to grabbing stuff.
Robin Hansen, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
It's great to be here. Good luck with the rest of your shows.